Welcome back to Teaching Tuesdays. If you remember, last week we finished up the literary terms lessons, and now we're going to move on to something different. Now, Teaching Tuesdays are going to be, for quite a while now, are going to be American literature based. I use these lessons in my junior classes whenever I teach American Lit, the stuff that I use. So it's going to look a little different each week. We're going to have different units, and in those units, they're going to have different lessons, but they'll all go into what is known as an American literature class. So just bear with me. I'll do some history background for most of the, units to just kind of give you guys some hints about what's going on. I'll give you some background on some of the authors that we'll meet, and then we'll start in with the different lessons of the different authors that and works that I wanted to hit on. No pun intended there. There will be sometimes, like, there will be one play that we'll talk about during the American Lit Teaching Tuesday sections. I'm not going to read the play just because, one, it's a play, and two, it's going to be very difficult for me to do all the voices. You guys are going to not really want to listen to that, so I would recommend that you get a copy of that play if you haven't read it before, or just listen to the summation of what the play is. I'm planning, key emphasis on planning, to give a summation of what the play is about, and then go through and talk about, okay, this is what happened here, this is why these characters did this and that. I'm still working on getting the fine tunings of those, but it'll be a couple of weeks from now before we actually get into that play. But that is what my planning is, that I will not read the play, but I will just discuss it and kind of give you the summation of each act, what happened, and then hit on some of the things that you guys are going to need to know to be able to think critically about it. So that is kind of the introduction of how we're going to kind of schedule the Teaching Tuesdays from here on out. So if there's a play and or novels, because I'm pretty sure I'm going to add some novels towards the end, it will just be, we'll have to play it by ear. Those are the words that I'm trying to think about. So just roll with the punches. Go with me if you guys have any thoughts, questions, concerns. Don't hesitate to let me know. But that's the gist of it. Alright, so like I said in the introduction, we will be doing American literature for the different Teaching Tuesdays from here on out for quite a while. What I'm using is, as I said in the introduction, from what I used in American literature classes when I taught. So the first lessons and unit that we're going to look at is the colonial time period. And all of that, since this is American literature, we're going to start with at the beginning. So how I'm going to schedule this out is, as I said earlier, we'll do history background, and then we'll do works from the authors, a more in-depth look at the authors themselves as we go along. So today is just, we're going to focus on the history of the colonial times. So one question you guys might be thinking is, when did the colonial time period actually officially take place? What were the years that, if we could put year on them, what would they be? The most widely accepted time frame would be 1607 to 1776. 1607 is when Jamestown was first discovered, and that's considered to be the first official colonial settlement in America. Yes, Christopher Columbus came before then, but he was more in Central America as opposed to North America. And when we do American literature, we do just primarily North America. So that's why we say 1607, when Jamestown was officially established, up to 1776 when the Revolutionary War took place. So that's what we consider the time frame for a colonial time period. All right, so the next kind of questions that I always ask my students to look into is, why did people come to America to colonize it? Well, there were practical motivations related. Overpopulation, religious persecution, poverty. A vast majority of the people who came over in 1607 to Jamestown did so because of religious persecution that they underwent in back in Europe. It's a big old long story. I'm not going to get into the whole depth of all of that. If you want to know more, research some of the history of why they left. But they were called the Puritans and the Pilgrims, and they all sought to establish their religion first in England. I'll talk a little bit about that later, but they wanted to establish the religion that they followed, and they felt that England, where they originated, were born and raised in, was not allowing them to do that, and they were fearful for their lives, so they moved to Holland. It was okay there for a while, but then they decided to move to come to America, to the New World, where they wouldn't have that as heavy of persecution as they were meeting over in Europe. Because there was lots of civil unrest as well as the persecution they felt. So, as I said, Jamestown was the first one in 1607 that they established. But Plymouth Colony, Massachusetts Bay Colony, were the ones that subsequently happened after Jamestown. So another reason why they left England and the continental Europe nations was because of overpopulation and poverty that they were experiencing. England, primarily, since they were of English descent, it had an unstable economy at the time that they left, in late 1500s, early 1600s. Caused inflation to grow drastically, therefore making the number of those in poverty grow as well in relation to the inflation. Many of these immigrants chose to seek out new sources of income, and all those were from the New World. A lot of these colonists were indentured servants because they were considered to be in poverty level, and they bargained their freedom from England for seaward passage to the New World. A lot of these indentured servants were unmarried and sought to work off their debts that they either accumulated in England and or in being able to go to the New World, their passage on ships in the colonies. They primarily worked on the plantations where sugar, tobacco, cotton were profitable ventures, or at the time promising profitable ventures. But some were not sent willingly. There were an estimated 50,000 convicts that were sent to the colonies just from Great Britain. I don't know what percentages of that came from England, Wales, Ireland, and Scotland, but Great Britain, just in and of itself, sent an estimated 50,000 to convicts to the colonies in the 17th century. So it wasn't all a great influx at once, but America was seen as a penal colony to begin with. And then it became more of what we think of the colonial time period, like we think of now. Another question I ask my students to look up and to find information about is, what kind of struggles did the settlers experience during that time period? Well, starvation, disease, suffering, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, everything. In the first year of the settlement of Jamestown, about 38 people, the original 144 colonists, survived. And that was because of Indian attacks, Indian raids, the starvation, disease, attacks from other migrating nations, you know, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the French, whatever. If they were not on speaking terms and they saw people on land that looked to be promising, the warring nations, quote-unquote, would fight. And therefore, it would cause... So, the colonists were fighting battle on both fronts, on sea and on land. So, those are just some of the struggles. Well, it's not all of them, but those are just some of them. And then, the next thing I asked them is, looking at a timeline of the colonial time period in 1692, not 1492, 1692, what happened? Because that is a big influence on to what we would study in this unit. That would be the Salem Witch Trials. And there were other trials that took place kind of during that time, but they were not nearly as extensive nor get the same amount of press that the ones in Salem did. Alright, so then I kind of shift gears a little bit and ask them to do a little more research on their own to find out some more answers. The first question in this new area is, who were the first Europeans to explore the New World that we now call the United States? So if you heard me and were listening closely, I said Europeans, not English Europeans. A lot of people would say Christopher Columbus in 1492. I already hinted at that. He was of Italian descent, who was commissioned by the Spanish, Portuguese, one of those two nations, to go in 1492 to find the New World for Spain and Portugal, whichever one exactly it was. But Christopher Columbus is the one that we give the most credence to. There was another European sailor, navigator, explorer who found North America about 500 years before Christopher Columbus. And that was a man by the name of Leif Erikson. He was from Greenland. So in around the year 1000, he and his men landed somewhere in present-day Canada, probably just off the coast of Labrador. They really didn't make a permanent settlement, and the discovery was largely forgotten for quite a long time, even though there was still some evidence that it did happen. Otherwise, we wouldn't know about it today, but it was largely forgotten. And then in light of Christopher Columbus, it was definitely pushed to the back burner, if not almost off the stovetop of thought. Alright, so then I asked them when and where was the first colony founded, so they know that, you know, the time frame that I was looking for began in 1607, so that would mean that would be the first colony when, and the where would be in Jamestown, Virginia, if you remember me talking a little bit ago about that. Alright, so then the next question I have them look up is, in the 1700s, who made up the largest percentage of the colonial population? And the main answer that I would usually get would be the enslaved Africans. By 1770, more than 2 million people lived and worked in Great Britain's 13 North American colonies. So a vast majority of the percentage of those 2 million people estimated were those who were enslaved. I'm sure there were also a lot of indentured servants from Europe as well that came over So very, very, very few of them in the 1700s were free. Alright, so then the last question in this section, I asked them to find a timeline of the period and write down an interesting event from that time. So I usually get quite a few, but here's some that I always thought were interesting. Well, first one's about Columbus. He was the first European to, quote-unquote, officially find America. He was an Italian sent by the Spanish. The first English explorer to North America was John Cabot in 1497, about 5 years later. It wasn't until the reign of Queen Elizabeth, and she reigned from 1558 to 1603, that England began to send more explorers. So it wasn't for, you know, almost 100 more years after Columbus that England actually officially, quote-unquote, sent people to America. Some of those men were Sir Walter Raleigh, Sir Francis Drake, John Smith, and others. Those were some of the men that went out. Another interesting tidbit that I always like to mention was the colony of Roanoke. It was founded in 1585, then there was Jamestown in 1607, Plymouth in 1620, New Hampshire and Carolina colonies started in 1629, then there was Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630, the Province of Maryland in 1632, then the colonies of Connecticut and Rhode Island in 1636, New Haven in 1637, and the list can go on and on and on and on. But in those, you know, 50-some-odd years, we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 places in about 30 years, colonies in 30 years, that were established in North America, just on the East Coast. And I highly recommend doing some research, asking your history buff friends to help you dig into that American history of that part of America if you want to know more. All right, so then I go on to the next section of questions. This is section number 3. So the first thing I ask the kids to do, because one of the things, you know, if you've been listening, is there was lots of religious persecution going on in England that caused people to come over. I asked them to find the definition of Puritan and write down and any pertinent facts about that. So I kind of went really in-depth. Most of the kids that I taught never really went this far in. They just kind of, you know, did the normal high school, put down the basics, there you go. But I'm going to go a little in-depth for those of you who like a lot of information. So, a Puritan was a member of a group of English Protestants of the late 16th and 17th centuries who regarded the reformation of the Church of England under Elizabeth as incomplete and sought to simplify and regulate forms of worship. So to put that more in layman terms, there were a group of people who thought that the way that the church was going at that time in England wasn't good, and they thought it was more too ritualized, too similar to how the way that the Roman Catholic Church was doing it, and wanted to have a more simple form of worship and study of the word, and to regulate more of how it was all set up. So one of the words in there was Protestant. Now, most people who were not raised in a semi-religious home probably don't know what Protestant means. But then again, there may be those who are raised in a religious home who don't know what Protestant is and what that means. So, a Protestant is just a member or follower of any of the Western Christian churches that are separate from the Roman Catholic Church. And those people follow the principles of the Reformation. So A Protestant would be more of the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Lutherans. Those are just some examples of those who would be labeled as Protestant. Again, another thing that in that big definition earlier, the Reformation of the Church of England, you might not know exactly what that is off the top of your head, so I decided to go ahead and get information for that. So, if you remember King Henry VIII of England, he was the one who had 6 wives. He wanted to be able to divorce his first wife so he could marry his second wife. Well, during that time, England was Catholic. And so, he wanted to find a way that where he could do that. But the Catholic Church, especially at that time, I'm not sure at this time, but at that time, prohibited divorce. And so that divorce was a sin that would keep you out of heaven. So he decided, well, I don't agree with that, so we're going to break away from the Catholic Church located in Rome, and I'm going to start my own church here in England, and I'm going to be the head of the church, and this is how we're going to do it. So the Archbishop of Canterbury kind of paired up with him. So, Henry was the secular leader, where the archbishop was the spiritual leader. So then they moved beyond the permanent Catholic control, although a lot of the liturgy and governances, using bishops and everything, started to weave its way into the beginnings of the tradition of the Anglican Church, or the Episcopal in America. But that then led to Lutheran and Reformed theology invaded Anglicanism during the short reign of Edward, which was Henry's son. And there's a lot more to go into that, but that's kind of how the Reformation started. Another little bit of information, Mary Tudor was one of Henry's daughters. She remained Catholic. When she became queen, she persecuted those who refused to abandon that new religion of Protestantism and Anglicanism, and she burned those who refused to turn back to, Catholicism and Catholics, come back to being Catholic. There were about 800 who fled the continent during the time that she reigned. John Calvin was Mary's half-brother. John Calvin, he was one of those more radical reformers. Queen Elizabeth, Mary's half-sister, she succeeded Mary, got her off the throne, and went back to the religion that Henry, her father, had established. She was the one who helped the Protestantism rise again in England and helped those Reformed theologies form a bit. But, as those people started to return, they felt that Elizabeth's Reformation really hadn't gone far enough to where it would survive for long term. It was good short term, but long term they didn't think that she had done enough. So they said, okay, we need to get the church fixed, all of that stuff. So in 1563, they became known as Puritans, who were the people who criticized the liturgy, the ceremonies, lack of discipline, especially those in the clergy, the pastors, the bishops, all those people. They decided that they were going to, there need to be more independent thought and church autonomy, as opposed to the bishops have control. They dictate how churches run, what the people who go to church need to do. They didn't like that. They thought that God was sovereign, that he needed to be the one to give them those directions and that tell them what to do, not the bishops and men. It needed to be God. The Puritans, they thought that the human rituals and institutions that had kind of still remained there from going from Catholicism to Protestantism, that they thought those were idolatrous in positions, on the Word of God, that it was more of what can I do to get to heaven as opposed to believing that God did what he did to save them, that people, but instead the church was so caught up on that you have to, people have to do X, Y, and Z in order to get to heaven, that sort of thing. The Puritans wanted to get rid of those old remnants that still remain from Catholicism, and they wanted to turn more towards what you would think of Baptists and Lutherans and Presbyterians. They saw themselves as members of a church, not founders of a new church. But the rest of, a lot of people who were not Puritans didn't see it that way, and that's what led to the religious persecution and why they left England to go to Holland for a while, and then from Holland to the New World eventually. Alright, so that was kind of like a long, that was a long, heavy bit of information there for section 3. If you want to know more, I recommend that you go to a good church that will help you walk through that. But I'm not going to continue on that here. So we're going to move on to the fourth section of questions that I would ask the kids. This deals more with the literary terms as opposed to the historical and religious reasons why the colonial period is what it is. So the first question of section 4 is, what are some of the central themes from this time period? If you haven't picked up on it yet, there's a lot of religious themes in the colonial time period because they were still, in a way, forming the church, and the church that they had helped, were working on, was still in its infancy. So they were, that's what their writings and their society was heavily influenced on, because they were so, it was ingrained in them that they needed to be very religious. Also, they had some information about the migration from Europe to North America, that, you know, kind of history and biographical type stuff, like, this is what happened, these are the people who were involved, this is what it was like, X, Y, Z, what it was like going from Europe to North America, what we found in North America, everything that you kind of see in a history book. Their faith controlled their lives, and they felt that it was their job to glorify God and set an example to other Christians who would be reading it. So they had very strict religious rules and very strict social rules. All of those rules were harshly enforced, sometimes to the point of ridicule, being beaten, that sort of thing, if you didn't follow the rules that were set up. And of course, they had lots of Puritan values and beliefs that aided in those rules. It was a very patriarchal society, so men were, well, the man said, goes, you don't question what the man says. Also, they valued God above all else, worked to please him, hence the strict religious rules that were harshly enforced. Their beliefs that they was that they lived in the world, but should not be of the world. That's one of those religious questions that if you aren't quite sure about, you need to go ask someone you know will be able to give you that answer. They believed that the church should follow the Bible very strictly, should have a strong work ethic, believing that working hard glorified or made God look good. A lot, and I can't reinstate this enough, the genre of the literature, very religious. Sermons, letters, that were vast majority of what was written, if it wasn't the history of, okay, this is what happened, these are the people who were involved, the political documentations of the charters of the colonies, who was in charge, who was the next head honcho on down the line. There was some poetry, and that's the first thing, that type of literature that we'll look into, but there was very little poetry. Much of this came from the fact that they were very religious and found that anything that didn't deal with their form of Christianity was wrong and shouldn't be focused on. So that's why there's very little poetry that you'll see coming out of that time period. Because anything that, you know, poetry, fiction, anything that's fiction, poetry, short stories, novels, nah. They didn't really see any of that as a type of entertainment that should be encouraged. So that's why you see very little of that outside of anything that dealt with the church or politics. Alright, so that's kind of the literary type things that you'll see. Then I asked the kids to list 5 authors and what kind of literature they use, and then to choose 3 of them and give some interesting background information. So the first one, author that I always see, and I always made my students write down, was Anne Bradstreet, because she was one of the most famous poets of that time. Not only poet, but she was pretty much the only female poet that we actually have poems still in existence from that time period. So poetry was rare, but even rarer that it was a woman who wrote it during that time. Because remember, men were the head of the house, what they said went, no questions asked. The second person that I would see a lot of would be William Bradford. He did lots of histories, biographies, possibly some political documentation. He wrote that. John Smith is another one. He did lots of biographies and histories of all of his travels, what he experienced, people he saw. Hence the reason the movie Pocahontas, because of everything that John Smith wrote down. Jonathan Edwards, he is one of the most famous people who wrote sermons and everything. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God is an example of a sermon that he wrote. And then finally, Cotton Mather. He wrote lots of biographies, historical accounts, almanacs, pamphlets, many other things. But those are 5 authors who helped with some of those Puritan literature that we see. So of those 5, I chose 3. So, of course, Anne Bradstreet's the first one. And we'll talk a little bit more about her later. I might repeat some of the things that I'll say today when we talk about Anne Bradstreet, but I want to give you some information today. So she was born in England in 1612. She then migrated to the New World in 1630. Because remember, 1607 is when Jamestown was founded. So she was born about 5 years after Jamestown was founded. Then went, you know, the year after Plymouth Colony. But in the New World, once she was there, she became overwhelmed by the conditions of how prevalent sickness was in the New World, the lack of food, the primitive living conditions that they had compared to what they had all been experienced and accustomed to in England. She was the mother of 8 children. And while they were living in America, she struggled to be able to take care of them just because there was a lack of food. Those living conditions were very primitive. Lots of people were sick. And because she's a poet, you know, she would write her poetry, and then she had to take care of her kids. And then the fact that they were in America, which was as primitive as it was compared to England, it was much harder for her to be able to balance all of that. And her brother-in-law actually had to assure the other Puritans that she wasn't passing up on those duties that a Puritan woman would have to do, you know, taking care of her kids and taking care of the house, because she was writing her poetry, but she still was able to do that. And because she was a woman, her writing was criticized all the time. Lots of men stole her ideas because they thought, oh, she's a woman, it doesn't really matter, I'm a man, that's all that matters. She only ever had 1 book of poems published in her lifetime, and that was in 1650, And that book of poems was called The Tenth Muse Lately Sprung Up in America. So, she was like Van Gogh, only had one thing published. Van Gogh only had sold one painting in his lifetime. Anne Bradstreet only had one book of poems published. So, if you want to go look at that, you can. The second person that I would see a lot of would be William Bradford. He came over on the Mayflower in 1620 as a separatist. He became the governor of Plymouth Colony in 1621. He wrote of Plymouth Plantation. He wrote about the separatists' success and conflicts in their journey to the New World. And as I said, of Plymouth Plantation, it discusses the journeys of the pilgrims to the Netherlands in 1608, and then to America on the Mayflower in 1620. The work tells what happens to each of the pilgrims on the Mayflower, and one of those being John Smith, who helped since he had kind of gone to America before, earlier. He was, because as an explorer, and he was an English soldier, so that kind of helped with some of the protection, because they had women and children going with them, because he had gone over to help with Jamestown when that had experienced food shortages. Smith's relationship with the Indians, having been there before, you know, really helped them to be able to get food and help from them. He encouraged the settlers to take responsibility for their work, because John Smith eventually became the governor of Plymouth, I think it was. And he made his famous quote, "He who does not work does not eat," because a lot of them were too busy trying to find gold instead of working to get the food and the shelters and everything. He's like, okay, if you guys expect to be able to eat, you need to put in some work. And the work is dictated by what needs to be done, not finding gold, trying to look for gold. He had lots of leadership and survival skills that helped, because he had lived in Virginia wilderness with the Indians for a while, and it made him one of the first American authors to discuss the themes of industry, self-creation, and practicality. One of the very first books that documented the history of the territory was his. It's called The General History of Virginia, New England, and the Summer Isles. And this just dealt with how the whole history of the territory administered by the Virginia Company. It was published in 1624. Alright, so that is all that I have for today. We will continue on reading the next few weeks, some of Anne Bradstreet's poems. We'll talk about some of the history, a little bit more of the Salem Witch Trials, which then led to the writing of the play The Crucible by Arthur Miller. And we'll talk about that down the road. And let me see, making sure I'm not getting ahead of myself here. Just give me a moment to look at my notes. A lot of notes that I have right now. Down. Yeah, and then we might talk about some of Jonathan Edwards' work. I don't know. But we'll definitely do some Anne Bradstreet's poetry, and then the Crucible play. We'll talk about that, and then I might talk about some of the assessments that I would do for the end of the unit. And then we'll go from there. So thank you for listening to today. Hopefully you found some interesting information here. And I hope you come back next week for Anne Bradstreet poetry.